You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'd like to welcome everybody to Brookings. I think we have a very exciting day, and we're going to start off with a great treat, which is to welcome Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Tim, of course, needs no introduction. As you know, he has been one of the key players with Ben Bernanke, with Larry Summers, with Henry Paulson, in stemming the tide of this financial crisis and starting to turn the economy around. He also has been the architect of the financial reform proposals that became the Dodd-Frank bill. And one of the pieces that was not included in this bill was what to do about the GSEs. So now today, Treasury has released a white paper describing their plans on that issue. And we're just very delighted that you chose to come here to Brookings to talk about it. So let me ask you, first of all, if you would give us a sort of brief description of what the plan is and how is it going to be implemented.
Thank you, Martin. Nice to be at Brookings. And you guys had good timing for your conference today, and I'm glad you gave me a chance to come in at the beginning. So we obviously got a lot of things wrong in the housing market in the United States, and it is a complex system, and reform requires a careful strategy that includes a number of different elements. Let me just lay out the basic pillars, the basic foundations of what we think is a credible reform plan. The first, of course, is that we need to wind down Fannie and Freddie and substantially reduce the government's footprint in the housing market. And that's a process that has to happen gradually because they are now the dominant source of housing finance. And we want to be careful that that process happen in a way that doesn't interfere with or impede the process of repair in the housing market that still has a long way to go. For the private market to take on a greater share of the burden of providing housing finance, we have to have in place, outlined and understood, a new set of rules of the game for all the pieces of the mortgage market. And that means clarity on the capital banks have to hold against mortgage risk. It means stronger underwriting standards so that homeowners have to hold more equity in their homes. It means better protection for consumers, comprehensive oversight of servicers and all others involved in the basic chain of housing finance. It means better incentives for securitization, clarification on risk retention. That comprehensive set of reforms that are laid out in Dodd-Frank have to be put out to the market and to give investors and banks time to adjust, to understand what will be the new economics of making mortgages in this country. The third piece is to define a substantial but more targeted role for the government in supporting affordability, both for people who want to own a home and people who want to rent. And the paper lays out a series of basic elements of a reformed role for the government, concentrate on the FHA in helping support those basic objectives. And finally, of course, is the end game. And taking advantage of a lot of work that many of you have done, we provide a brief overview of the full spectrum of options out there for future reform. And we try to narrow the field to a more credible set of ultimate reform options. And the three we lay out in the paper, just to summarize them briefly, are an approach that is limited to the role the FHA provides, a proposal that would complement the FHA's role with an emergency backstop mechanism that would only be deployed in crisis, and a third option is an FHA alongside a redesigned and much more limited but standing guarantee or insurance mechanism that would be available for a broader class of homeowners. Those all have very different implications for the nature of the government's support, for the vulnerability of the market in future housing crises, future recessions. And we think it's helpful for the broad set of stakeholders in the country and on the Hill to spend some time trying to fully understand the implications, the relative merits, the disadvantages of those mix of options. In laying those out, we do take the view that it would be fundamentally untenable for the country to adopt a model where the government plays no role. And we also think it would not make sense for the country for the government to be in a position on an ongoing basis of guaranteeing 80-90% of the mortgage market, which many people have suggested. So we start this process of legislation with a white paper, which I think is a good way to do it. There's going to be a long process of hearings on the Hill. When we get a little further in that process, then Congress should be in a position to legislate, and we will at that point provide our views more directly on what mix of those final options makes sense. But again, we're going to make sure we don't have a monopoly of wisdom and ideas. There's a lot of good ideas out there. We try to draw on those in this paper, and we'll continue to work very closely with all the stakeholders in this process so that we're taking advantage of the best ideas for reform out there. Of course, we need to proceed carefully and gradually, not just because this is very complicated, but as you know, we're still living with the traumatic damage scars caused by this recession. You see those still in housing most powerfully.
Now, in the plan, you retain an important role for the government in helping affordable housing, helping people either rental housing or ownership housing. Now, there are a set of people. We've got a range of interesting papers for this conference that cover the sort of spectrum. But there is a view that the effort to provide affordable housing is really what brought down the housing market. And that was, you know, do-gooders that thought they should get everyone into a home. And we ended up through CRA and through these affordable housing goals that brought down the global market. Could you comment on this sort of affordable housing and the role you think it may or may not have played in the crisis?
Well, I think it's absolutely the case that the U.S. government provided too much support for housing, too strong incentives for investment in housing, and we just took that too far. And alongside that basic set of mistakes in the incentives we created, we allowed our financial system to take on too much leverage. We allowed a huge amount of basic mortgage business to shift where there was no regulation oversight. We allowed the market to build up really terrible incentives around underwriting securitization. We allowed underwriting standards to erode dramatically. And those things are, I think they were avoidable mistakes. And again, it's important to recognize that this was not just about what Fannie and Freddie ultimately did to follow the market down. It was about a much more comprehensive set of failures in the basic design of oversight and incentives in the system. And so absolutely the government did too much, and what it did quite poorly. And as you know, a lot of the basic subsidies and incentives the government provided were not really targeted to people who were at the lower side of income across the United States. So our general view is there's a very important role for the government, not just in providing access to affordable housing, but in getting the incentives better, oversight better, constraints on risk-taking better, underwriting standards more conservative, and that's a critical part of this reform plan.
Now, sort of in the other direction a little bit, there is a viewpoint, two parts to it. Let me take this part, which is that you inevitably, there's going to be a huge mortgage market. We're going to have we have $10 trillion. Who knows? It'll be bigger in the future. At some future time, maybe 20 years from now, there might be another housing crash like this one. Okay. So that risk then, who's going to bear that risk? Is that going to put our financial system under stress, even if we have no Fannie and Freddie? And is there a role for the government to provide emergency assistance when you get that kind of crash of the housing market? Or are there, and I think there are things you're trying to build in which would make such a crash less damaging. But
all financial crises, of course, have at their center, most do, this combination of real estate busts and bank mistakes. And we're not unique in that context. To make sure the system is more stable in the future, more resilient against the risk of future recessions or house price booms and busts, you need to have a system where, again, banks hold more capital against risk, people have more equity in their homes, and the government is not creating incentives that magnify the chance you have these huge imbalances over investment in housing over time. Now, I think it's worth noting that, at least my view is that even if you get that stuff substantially better, and we will, I'm very confident we can do that, we're still going to have recessions in the future. And you want to be very careful you don't leave the country vulnerable, as we were in this crisis, to the risk that a shock that causes a recession turns into a crisis of these dimensions. And that requires there be some capacity for the government to step in and protect the economy from the collateral damage that can come from that sort of crushing deleveraging, big withdrawal of private capital that happens in crises. But, of course, doing that is terribly difficult. Governments don't do that well. People think guarantees are cool and interesting, but they're very hard to do in a way that doesn't create the risk that political forces end up making them too generous, too cheap, and undermining these incentives to get a better balance of risk-taking. So in thinking about the future, and this is why we laid out the options we did, is it's very important for people to think through the design questions. So again, we don't end up recreating some of the same risks that got us in this mess.
Could you say a word about the role of securitization in this? Historically, or at least for the last 20, 30 years or so, the U.S. has been a large capital importer. I think probably you and I would like it better if we had a smaller trade deficit and less of a capital import. But
It was at the peak, I just want to say.
Sorry?
Our current account and balance is half what it was at the
half
peak.
Half what it was at the
Americans
peak.
Americans are saving
right
more.
Direction.
That's a good thing.
Definitely, definitely. But anyway, we are somewhat reliant on inflows of capital, and securitization therefore tends to play an important role if that inflow is going to support the housing market at all. We got into a lot of trouble with securitization, non-transparent CDOs, and you talk a bit about that in the paper. So could you say a bit more about how do we revive, do you think we should revive securitization? How do we revive securitization? And how do we stop it getting into trouble the way it got into trouble in this crisis?
My view is that we should preserve a financial system that in which banks are a substantial source of credit, but not the only source of credit, and their role is complemented by a capital market, including securitization market, that can complement the classic role of banks. We are somewhat unique in that design of a financial system, and making sure that works over time requires the type of reforms I laid out to make sure the incentives are better in the securitization market and that the design of capital requirements, other things like that, are more evenly applied and better calibrated to take into consideration the risks of the extreme crisis in the future. But I think those are achievable reforms. I think it's pretty clear what we got wrong in the basic securitization market, and there's, I think, a lot of consensus on changes that make a big difference. And I would not support trying to create a system where banks are the overwhelmingly dominant source of credit. I think that would leave economies more vulnerable to the inevitable problems that comes with banking, you know, familiar problems to many in this room about banking. And that's true. But again, just to go back to one thing, you know, again, there are a lot of mistakes in how we design the housing market. But, you know, at its core, this crisis was caused by a whole range of people, lenders, homeowners, investors, policymakers, not imagining the possibility of a severe recession that would include a very sharp role in housing crisis. And central to anything about reform financial system is that you make sure that the capital regime, the oversight regime, credit rating processes build in more care and caution about the risks of the severe event in the future.
In the paper, you talk about wanting to move to a 10% down payment regime. So two questions. Is 10% enough? Some people say we need 20%, which a lot of countries have. And the second is, how do we deal with the sort of second mortgage issue that people, in fact, say they're getting it 10%, but then the primary mortgage holder doesn't know that there's a second mortgage on top of that. So talk a little bit about what I think is right. We need to get the loan-to-value ratios in the right place. How did you set 10%? How are you going to enforce something like that?
Well, I think fundamental is, again, this basic proposition that homeowners have to hold more equity in their homes. And they have to build in a greater cushion in their homes. And we want underwriting standards and whatever the role the government's playing to make sure they're reinforcing that basic process. Now, what the report says is that we think that if you think about Fannie and Freddie for the initial stage of this transition, there should be a combined limit, LTV, combined limit at 90%. And again, I think there's an overwhelming case for moving the system gradually over time to a world where homeowners hold more equity in their homes. Now, there are costs to doing that. And, you know, there's like hundreds of stories of businesses started in this country financed by people being able to borrow against the value of their equity at inception, not just on their credit card, but on their against their home. And we're going to have to figure out how to make sure we don't go too far in the other direction, because, you know, again, ultimately, what's the critical test of a financial system? You really want to make sure that it has the possibility of channeling the savings of Americans and investors around the world to finance innovation, including, and a lot of innovation comes at that initial level, you know, in the garage, classically, or somewhere else. And right. I think that we got to be careful we don't push the balance too far.
We've mentioned already a little bit about rental housing, but part of what you are saying in this white paper is that maybe we went too far on the home ownership and we need to make sure that people who want to rent, or it's better for them to rent, have the opportunity to rent. So what is the plan to improve access to rental housing?
Well, that's something my colleagues at HUD are going to be principally responsible for shaping, and I'll leave it to them. We make some initial suggestions in the paper, but again, the fundamental point is too much of the assistance the government's provided to individuals went to homeowners, and there is a fundamental unfairness in that. And so we think that we should alter the balance where the government's going to provide a subsidy in a way that redresses that basic unfairness.
You have laid out some options. Could you just clarify for us what are the options that you're laying out for Congress to consider?
Right. Well, I want to start by just making one observation, which is if you look at cross countries, people do this in different ways. And in a sort of simple way, you could say there was our model, where you had a variety of quite broad-based and very poorly designed guarantees by the government, explicit and implicit.
Right.
Alongside a private market. And you have, at the other extreme in lots of countries, a system where banks really hold an overwhelming share of mortgage risk. And people tend to think about this as a world where there's a guarantee or there's not a guarantee. But that's not the right way to think about it. In the alternative model, where banks hold all the risk, the governments are providing a guarantee. They're just doing it through that classic broad support for the banking system. They don't charge for it. It's not explicit. And it has a lot of other risks to how you think about financial stability in this context. Now, some people say, well, you can manage risks in banks more carefully, more easily. We understand the risks there better, which may be the case, although, as you saw, that's not as easy as people think. So the choice is not really between are you going to provide a guarantee or not. It's in designing it so that where it is, it's explicit. The taxpayers aren't too exposed. You're not creating bad incentives for investment and for risk-taking. And that's sort of, I think, a helpful context. But again, the three broad options we lay out are what we call the FHA-only model, where the government's role is limited to guaranteed mortgage that would only be available to people up to the median income. Second option we allowed as a complement to that is what you might call an emergency backstop framework that we've deployed only in the context of a crisis. A good example of this is the suite of facilities that the Federal Reserve, and it's nice to see Don Cohn here, that put in place in the fall of 98 and in early 09 to provide a basic backstop for markets. And in that context, the way that would work is you'd set up this mechanism whereby the market would be more willing to provide financing to mortgages because there would be a backstop in place temporarily. And if you get the pricing in that right, as things improve, demand for the backstop will recede, and you can wind down these facilities as things improve, as the Fed did so deftly in the crisis. A third option, and there are a lot of proposals in this arena, in this neighborhood, is a fundamentally redesigned, much more limited guarantee or reinsurance mechanisms where there'd be a lot of private capital ahead of the government, and the markets would be charged a fee for that guarantee. It would be explicit by the government, but the taxpayers would be behind a lot of private capital. And if the government mispriced the guarantee and was exposed to loss, that would be recouped in the form of a fee on the broader market over time. It has some similarities to the FDIC regime, deposit insurance regime, although it's much more complicated to do in this context. So, again, our view is that that's the credible set of options. But they're, you can't think of them in isolation. And it's possible, of course, that what we'll do in the end is decide on a mix of those options. And again, you have to think about them in terms of what risks do they pose to the taxpayer? How difficult is it going to be to design the guarantee in a way that doesn't, again, get the incentives wrong and leave the taxpayer too exposed? What kind of protections do you want to build in for the country in the next crisis? And whether that can be provided through just an emergency backstop mechanism or requires the government taking, even in normal times, some of the extreme risk of credit and mortgages off the burden of the private market. But that's mixed. And, you know, we're in the, I would say, a lot of ideas in those dimensions. And, again, just to magnify the challenge, for this to be done well, you have to take it away from politics. You can't take it away from politics, but you know we have taken monetary policy away from politics. Hugely important fundamental reform in central banking. It'd be nice to take fiscal policy away from politics, but that's not foreseeable. If you're going to do this, you're going to get in this mechanism of designing a guarantee, and you have to make sure that the people charged with doing it will be more independent from political affection, enthusiasm, influence than our system proved to be before.
You're sort of talking about a pretty staged out wind down for Fannie and Freddie. It would be over several years, and actually, I personally think that's inevitable. You got to do that, but I think someone could look at that and say, on both sides of the aisle, that people complain about Fannie and Freddie, but at the end of the day, they want those mortgages because they're so important to their constituents, and you're going to put it off for 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, and actually this is never going to happen. What would be your answer to that?
Well, I think it's a good question. Of course, any framework, let's think about fiscal policy, any framework where you're promising future virtue will suffer from credibility issues, but this is really the only way you can do it. And what we're proposing, we laid out the first stage of more economic pricing, more sensible set of initial reforms to get the economics better. And what we're suggesting is the FHFA, which has the legal authority over this for Fannie and Freddie, and the FHA lay out to the market an indicative transitional path for comment, in a sense, for feedback. And then they can lay that out. The market can sort of figure out what that path is. We have to revisit over time because we won't have perfect knowledge about how long this process of repair will be or where the pricing should end up. And I think that'll help reinforce the momentum, the change, and make it harder for people ultimately to step back from that transition. Now, again, we have some important things working in our direction apart from the general recognition that this system is untenable. And that is that they don't want the taxpayer exposed to loss in the future. And they recognize the model we have is fundamentally unacceptable. And the option of doing nothing, leaving ourselves only with the legislative authority that exists in what's called HERA, I think would put us in the position where we risk recreating a lot of the flaws in the system we created. And again, one of the virtues of doing this, you know, we did financial reform when the crisis was still burning in the United States, and we did that in part because we thought that you want to act when there's still a substantial amount of political will.
Yeah.
And I'd say the same thing in housing. You don't want the process of reform to wait until things are fundamentally better and the memories receded, although it's going to take a long time for the memory of this to recede. So I think that's another reason for wanting to move now. And although we're starting with this white paper, we don't want legislation to be too far deferred. We can do this initial transition thing stages without legislation, but ultimately we're going to have to explain to the market what the end game is going to be, and we can't wait too long to lay that out.
So Fannie and Freddie will remain as government-held utilities in this transition period?
They will, and they have to.
Yeah. Okay, let me take a question or two from the audience. Yes, Karen.
Thanks. Karen Dinan from Brookings. So your paper lays out several alternative proposals, and we're going to see more alternatives laid out over the course of today's conference. So all told, it seems like we might be a ways away from locking in on a plan. So I was wondering if I could just build on your last response. Do you think this lack of a plan is hindering the mortgage market recovery, hindering mortgage origination and securitization, while at the same time increasing the government's exposure to risk?
Well, I think the three things that are still in the way of broader recovery are, one, the economics of what the government's doing now, because what the government does now in mortgages is more attractive economically than what the market's willing to do, and so you're right. But that's why we want to begin the process of changing the pricing and the LTVs, conforming limits, in a way that will help facilitate that transition. The second thing is lack of clarity about what the broad rules of the game are going to be over the rest of the private market for mortgages. You know, the Dodd-Frank Act requires a pretty complicated set of rule-writing exercises across the board, and we're the responsible agencies are starting to lay that out. But until that is in place, people can see them. Those final rules, people can see. It is going to be harder for banks to decide how much capital they want to put against this and for investors to decide what role they want to play in this. So that's a necessary precondition. And the third is, you know, just realistically, just a little bit of time. I mean, you know, again, we're 3 years into the process of adjustment in the housing markets. We probably have three more years left. And, you know, we're still pretty close to a deeply damaging financial panic. So we need to have a little more time for that uncertainty about the future to be reduced a bit. And I think those things require a little bit of time. But I think we lay out at least notionally a three-stage plan with that initial stage of the first steps in walking back the government's role comes alongside putting in place these broad rules of the game over the private market. And then we say 2 to 3 years again because we sort of feel like the housing market still needs another 2 to 3 years to recover. And then the second stage, we should be able to accelerate that process of transition. And then ultimately, you know, we'll have to choose this framework. I think, again, our suggestion is that Congress try to legislate the next 2 years, even though you don't have to lock in that successor regime until probably 5 to 7 years from now. The way we describe this is, you know, we're going to drive west. We're driving, everybody wants to go west. We sort of know where we're going to go, but somewhere around Salt Lake City, we'll make a choice about what mix of ultimate options.
Questions? Yeah. Alice. Can we have a microphone?
Alice Rivlin, Brookings. Your paper basically supports the role of the government in affordable housing, both rental and home ownership, and suggests that we do it on budget. We appropriate amounts for this rather than try to hide it somewhere. And that all seems to be good, but in a moment of great budget austerity, when everything's going to be facing cuts, won't it be sort of a hard sell to set up new kinds of programs that are oriented toward affordable housing?
I do think it will. But as you know better than anybody, you know, our long-term fiscal sustainability problem is fundamentally about long-term entitlements, particularly the cost of health care. And I think there is, we are, as a nation, can absolutely afford to make and commit to a set of targeted assistance for low, moderate-income Americans. And I think the challenge, again, is to do that in a way where it's more targeted and more transparent and on budget and a little more fair between renters and homeowners. But I think that's something we can afford. You know, as you know better than anybody, we're not going to solve our long-term fiscal problems by spending less on what we call non-defense discretionary spending. We are going to spend less in that area, and we're going to demonstrate substantial restraint on those areas, but we're still going to have to make sure we can sustain the capacity, and we can afford it, to make sure we're making investments in things that are critical to our capacity to grow in the future, and to make sure we're providing broad opportunity to Americans across the income spectrum. So I think it's affordable, but you're right, the politics of all this stuff will get much harder.
Good. Thank you very much.
Nice to see you all.
Secretary Geithner. I really appreciate you coming here. That was terrific.